Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Some of my favorite interviews that I've ever done are with unarguably smart people. Oh, they've included Craig Venter, the human genome decoder, or Richard Dawkins, the evolutionary biologist and famous atheist. Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz, I considered, I'm not normally a very competitive guy, but I just somehow had this feeling I loved the idea of debating Alan Dershowitz. It was like a signal moment. I lost, but it wasn't that bad. It wasn't a shutout. So that was good. Anyway, today I have the privilege of interviewing another smart person. He's got the name that I think wins the award for the waspiest name that has ever existed in American history. Whitfield Diffie. Right? Anyway, but he's, he is no chopped liver. He has just received the Turing Award. And if you haven't heard of this, this is like the fancy word. It's, I guess the way to describe it is they call it the Nerd Nobel. But this may grab your attention. That little prize, it wasn't like he got a plaque that went on the wall. He got $1 million. That ain't for chopped liver. The Nerd Nobel, the Turing Award, is like the Nobel for computer science. How did this guy get one? He did not bribe the award committee. He is one of the key brains behind modern-day computer security. Now, I got to admit, there's been rather a few breaches, including the Chinese deciding they've gotten into the federal government's nuclear or whatever weapons cache or database. But in fact, the modern-day computer security, something called public key, has allowed all of us to conduct thousands of transactions, billions of transactions, and send billions of messages without our stuff getting stolen, at least too often. Here to tell us what it's really like to be what is his actual title is cryptographer. It's only a small component of this thing called computer security. Whitfield Diffie, may I call you Whit?
You may.
Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you very much.
So how the hell can they give you $1 million? I'm being a little disinformed because it's just fair to say we're friends. So
I like you, Marty.
Oh, okay.
California, they'd say we're friends. In New York, we'd be more reserved for a
good
few
point.
Years.
But it is fair to say that over the last 6 or 7 years, you are a listener to this radio program, and you email me periodically to tell me little crap like, I use the mean instead of the median.
I bitched about that.
Only a friend would do that. Now, a California friend, at least. All right. So in that spirit of barbs, how the hell can they give you $1 million when there have been so many cyber breaches from a teenager getting into the Department of Defense computer network to millions of our credit card information stolen to, and let's not forget, Ashley Madison, the adult dating website? Why did they give you $1 million?
Well, let's start out with an important technicality. I only got half of it. I split it with my partner, Marty Hellman.
All right.
And what you're saying is, well, they ought to have sent us a bill. And the brief answer is, the cryptography is an indispensable but small part of computer security. Mm-hmm. And the cryptographers have made the same mistake that an Irish wolfhound made a couple of years ago. An Irish wolfhound killed the last wolf in Ireland, and that was terrible for the breed. There was no work for them to do anymore. The cryptographers pretty much made the mistake of solving their problem. Mm-hmm. Our piece is far and away the best cooked part of computer security. Mm-hmm. And from there it goes straight downhill. And I can hold forth for quite a while on why I believe that is.
So, in other words, basically, cryptography is just, like you say, the small component. When I think of cryptography, I think of Alan Turing, and I think of the movie, and I think of breaking the German code, Enigma, because that was it, the Enigma code. Tell me something that would surprise me about cryptography.
Well, time of World War II, quite a lot of what are called high-grade crypto systems meant to protect very long-term serious secrets were broken, and everybody got very nervous. You look at the history of cryptographic systems as opposed to all of security in NATO, in the U.S., and so forth after the war. They have rather long lifetimes. So cryptographic algorithms have ceased to be the most vulnerable piece of this. Mm-hmm. But the programming that implements them, the programming that does other things, because cryptography only enforces decisions. Mm-hmm. Programs have to sit and make decisions. All of those things are just in dreadful shape.
We talked about Turing, and I'm looking at this this doorstop of a book that you wrote with a very sexy title, Breaking Teleprinter Ciphers at Bletchley Park. Bletchley Park was the place where Alan Turing worked. Why would a guy who is a computer nerd spend, obviously, a hell of a lot of time writing a doorstop book on the history of cryptography and the like?
Well, let's see. That book is about Enigma is the best remembered crypto system broken at Bletchley Park. This is about the higher grade systems, the systems that ran between Hitler and the heads of armies. Mm. My approach to this work has been historical all along. Mm. For 2 years that I spent wandering around the country working on cryptography, the major work I read was David Kahn's The Codebreakers, 1,000-page book on the history of cryptography. I spent most of my original time trying to understand what a cryptographic system needed to do.
So it's like the review of the literature that every researcher does before they start on
doing something new. Yeah, but I didn't review as much of the technical literature as I did of getting the feel of the subject.
That's interesting. Tell me something that would give me a better feel for the art of cryptography.
I don't know whether I haven't thought about whether I think of it as an art in the sense that Knuth calls programming the art of computer programming. When I teach the subjects, I say it has three components. It has theory, it has practice, and it has culture. And the problem with it is that so much of its culture is secret that you get little trickles of cultural information of the kind you get in the Codebreakers and the kind you get here that you can pass on to students.
And so that's why you couldn't just sit in your office. You had to get out and talk to people because it is this secret little culture. So you had to engender the kind of trust with people that you could only get face-to-face. Is that why you didn't just... You're a computer guy. You didn't just sit and do emails and Google searches. Why?
Okay, well, we did already have email then, just barely, I think.
There's a phone, though. I mean, why didn't you just pick up the phone? Am I right that you felt it was a trust issue to get into that culture? You had to go around and meet them face-to-face?
That's too purposeful. I mean, the answer is one, I had been pinned down for years by the draft, and I wanted to travel. I originally planned to travel around the world.
Pinned down meaning?
Well, I needed to take tech jobs that would keep me deferred from the draft. So I was working at Stanford to do that. I got to be 26, and technicalities, aside, I figured they weren't going to get me, and they didn't. So I wanted to go off and travel around the world. I only got to traveling around the country because a few months into this, I met my wife. I describe as my first discovery. If I hadn't discovered her, I wouldn't have made any of the other discoveries. And the second, I was kind of thrown out because I was being paid for at Stanford by under-the-table money from NSA to work on proof of correctness of programs.
Wait a minute. NSA is under-the-table money? I love it.
Yeah, well, right. I don't think it's very far under the table as under the table gets, but it came to us through Naval Research Office or something of that kind.
All right.
And I was being supported to work on proof of correctness, which just incidentally is the most important problem in engineering. It was then, it is now.
What the hell is it?
I'm so grateful to get away from it because it hasn't made as much progress as cryptography.
What the hell is it?
You have a computer program. What you would like to have is a mathematical proof that says, here are the specs for the program. For example, the output square root program, the output x squared will equal a number. That's the spec. Now, here is the code, 50 instructions or something. You want to have a proof that shows that if you execute that code, you're going to get that result. Well, people can do things of that size, but nobody can prove the correctness of programs of thousands of lines, let alone millions of lines, that build up the modern world.
Isn't that just too big a problem because there's too many different situations, and rather than have these mathematical proofs, why can't you just empirically look and see how well it works?
Well, because that's the best we can do, and the result is it doesn't work very well, right?
Yeah.
Look, the reason you were talking about break-ins by the Chinese, you should have more respect for teenagers.
You're right.
Anybody, no matter how smart, there's somebody 2 years younger and twice as smart.
Yeah.
But the critical thing, it's a misunderstanding, so to speak, to think that you can debug a program by the current techniques against the attackers. Because, in fact, the attackers are the programmers. Right. You're saying, can we find all the bugs so if these guys were on our team, they couldn't find any more bugs? No, lots of bugs. They find bugs too.
I mean, that's why it always feels like you've got 1,000 smart programmers competing against the best hackers that are among the 7.3 billion people on the planet. Isn't it only, as some of the experts say, isn't it a matter of not if but when they get into our banking system and bring it to a halt, or our electric grid and bring it to a halt?
I've come to be very sympathetic to that. But let me point out to you, just for the go back to the narrow area of cryptography, which is much, much simpler. Right? Basically, we're not very worried about any of the high-grade cryptographic algorithms that are in use today being broken at the direct mathematical attack level, the level that Turing and the Bletchley Park people used at that time. However, the number of bugs in the programs, because there are millions of lines of the programs, is very significant.
Is the following analogy right? If I own a bicycle, and I can use one of those crypto locks, it's funny they call them crypto locks, and I can, and that is pretty hard to break. That's pretty diamond solid. But if all I can do is put a little dynamite underneath the bottom of the parking meter, and I can lift up the parking meter, is the problem that the parking meter is not secure, but the bike lock is just fine.
I think kryptonite's the name of those rocks.
That's right. Yeah.
And they're. No, that's a reasonably good example. Yes,
Funny. Okay.
It would take a remarkable saw to saw through the kryptonite lock, but an ordinary hacksaw would go through the
precisely.
Right,
that's my point.
Yeah, no, that's. But I think you also find a lot of things would just fall into the category of carelessness. Mm. Right.
That's the human condition.
Imagine, the parking lot, you want to collect the money by unscrewing the meter and screwing a new one on. Mm-hmm. And eventually somebody noticed that, and aside from stealing the money, they can steal the bike.
Right. You're listening to Work with Marty Nenke. You might want to ask, what the hell are we talking about here? I am, despite the light tone, I am talking with the winner of the Turing Award. It's a $1 million prize, the Nerd Nobel, essentially for the best computer scientist who's made a transformational difference. He is Whitfield Diffie. He is the author of a book on the history of cryptography, which, as he has said earlier, really does become critical to really understanding the feel behind the science. His book is called, I'm not expecting you to buy it, Breaking Teleprinter Ciphers at Bletchley Park.
He calls himself a friend.
Okay, let's go way back. You talked about teenagers. Let's talk about your genesis.
Let me just have 1 second to say that book, incidentally, is an historical edition of the final report on some work at Bletchley Park in 1945. Mm. So, in some sense, this is the editors of that book, although we wrote a great deal in the process. Okay. Now, about my origin.
Yes, your origin. Your fifth grade teacher told your class about substitution ciphers. These are, where one letter simply substitutes for another, and there's a simple little code. Now, millions of kids have heard about secret codes from the teacher, from reading, whatever, and very few went home to their dad and said, not only did you ask for a book on cryptography, you said you wanted a whole bunch. Really, if you look inward for a moment, what do you think it was within you that made you so anomalous?
I don't know. I liked cryptography. I worked on it at that time for a couple of weeks. And I'm I can't think quite of the word of this kind of spoiled, but for years I didn't want to work in cryptography because I thought everybody was interested in cryptography.
Huh.
I went to work. I knew about camouflage. I knew about poison gas and things like that when I was a teenager. I thought of that as one of the popular, military arts or something.
Huh.
And so exactly why that particular thing, bit me, I don't know. I mean, I worked on it a couple of weeks. I concluded that a scrambled Vigenère cipher, a transposed Vigenère cipher, was probably the end of the rainbow, And I didn't think about it again until I was at MIT.
So were you like the typical kid, typical boys, disproportionately boys? They like you, like they like poison darts. They like curare, you know, paralyzing things and all the, you know, gross
weapons. Artists and models. The committee asked him, what did you learn from comic books? One of the things was how to grow poison plants.
Exactly. So, you know, one of the things you had said that stimulated your interest in being serious about this as a career, you had heard, and it was incorrect, that the NSA, the National Security Agency, had its own little private, for its phone, in its building, its phone system, that it had its own little private little encoding, cryptogramming thing, which turned out not to be true. But was it your desire that you wanted to break it and listen in on
NSA
conversations?
No, I wanted to figure out how you could do that and gain from it.
How do you mean?
Because I had this very anti-organizational view of what a secure phone would mean. It means I call you and nobody else in the world can possibly understand what we said. Hmm. Well, from an institutional point of view, you do something very straightforward. We want to make a phone call. Something hands us a key for the purpose, which means that something could be listening to us. That doesn't bother them, but it did bother me. Hmm. And so that's why I got interested in what's become known as the key negotiation problem. You and I would have figured out a secret key that only the two of us know.
So that's where at its most elemental level, that's the password.
No. Password, okay. I mean, you could call it a password, but the critical point is at the basic level, you and I sit and negotiate in public. And even though all the observers heard every word out of each of our mouths, at the end of the time, we know a secret that the other observers don't know. That is the key primitive that took me years to come up with. Consider bridge bidding. Right? In bridge bidding, North and South understand each other a little better than East and West understand them, because each of them is looking at half of the hand they're discussing. Well, you can push that to the extreme, to where you really can squeeze out all the other people. And that's one of the two elements of public key cryptography.
Yeah, and public key cryptography is the basis for this thing called SST or site socket, whatever, that we've seen so many times whenever we get to a website. So I want to understand it better. So paint a picture of right now, if I am sending you a secure, let's say I'm making a purchase, you're selling me marijuana, and I am making the purchase, and I want to be sure not only is my cash secure, but our communication about the whatever it is secure. What is going on, and this is all online, what is going on my end and your end? What is this public key? What is going on?
Okay. Well, what you referred to, SSL, is now the marketing got to it and recalled it transport layer security, which makes more sense. The idea is that your client, your phone, your laptop or something is calling the Amazon server, the new Amazon POT division or something of that kind. You want to have a secure connection. Remember, two of you have never met before.
Right.
And you don't belong to some larger organization like DOD that handles these things for you. So you get what's called their public key. And that is sent to you in the form of, and this is one of the important things, they send you what's called a certificate. And a certificate is a signed message signed by a third party that's widely known. So this started out with a company called VeriSign. And VeriSign issued these certificates, and they had a deal with the browser companies. So your browser can recognize the signature on what's called Amazon's public key.
Got it. So let me say it again for paraphrasing purposes. So Amazon made a deal with this VeriSign thing. Amazon, and VeriSign sends them a certificate. Amazon is a certificate. It's not a literal certificate. It's a way of saying, yes, we can communicate with each other, and it's this little code thing, and it gets sent to me, and then is that right?
Yeah, okay. And you know it's very much like handing a credit card to the waiter. The credit card is hard to duplicate. It's a fancy piece of plastic and so forth, and it has your signature on the back. And in principle, I know they don't do this anywhere but in India, really. But when the waiter, you sign the bill, and the waiter compares your signature with the signature on the bill. Why did the waiter believe in the signature? Because you handed him the credit card, which would be hard for you to counterfeit.
Okay. All right. Let's I want to focus, because this show is about careers. Let me let our listeners know again. You listen to Work with Marty Nemco. I am talking with the most recent, just awarded, I was privileged that Witt invited me to the awards dinner. I met more smart people than I've met in a long time. He's the winner of the Turing Award for developing, certainly, a quantum leap, pardon the pun, because there's a lot of quantum stuff involved in this, a quantum leap in computer security, and he's here with us now. I want to focus on the job and career stuff, because this show is supposed to focus on that. In one of our email exchanges, you wrote, "I am more imaginative than smart." Tell me something about that.
Well, I mean, in what I wanted to do when I, you know, was a kid, I imagined myself being a mathematician like Gleason or Wiles, who would attack some problem that had been around since before I was born and pick it apart and solve it.
Fermat's Last Theorem kind of thing.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's Wiles' work. Exactly,
oh, okay.
Exactly. And it turned out not to have that ability, or I haven't done that yet. Right?
Hellman had that ability. Yeah.
Sorry? Hellman's better at it than I am. And the point is, what I turned out to be was able to think about something that was not at all well-defined. So I told you, I spent 2 years thinking about what a cryptographic system was supposed to do before thinking about much mathematics for how you would do it. And it's not really such a separation. But that's the essential point. I proved fairly good at finding ill-defined things and imagining the directions to solutions.
When as a kid we learned coding, cryptographic encoding, as simply substituting one number or one letter or series or whatever is for
right.
Right. What got you beyond that to more clever approaches? Can you think of what was the first? Was there a step? Was there a first step to say, "Oh, it doesn't have to be just a plain old substitution of a letter for another letter or whatever. It could be..." What was your first insight in that?
Well, I don't know. I may just plain have learned it. I mean, the great discovery in the history of cryptography is in the West around 1500, is that the problem with substitution systems is that the more often you use the same substitution, the more more information your opponent gets,
of course,
the more likely it is to be broken.
Right.
And they develop what we'll call polyalphabetic ciphers. They begin changing the substitution with every letter. And something like the Enigma machine is a machine for changing the substitution.
So it randomly, instead of L equals Q, L equals Q the first time, but then there's a random number generator that made it be some other number.
Right.
The next
roughly
time.
Speaking, yes. Mm-hmm. And modern systems do it every bit. Right, so you're running a million bits a second. Each bit is either flipped or not, depending on what the what the crypto device says.
So how do they break that now? That's breakable. So how do they break that? The fact that it's random numbers changing, substituting every letter for a different letter or number. How do they break that now?
Because the way they aren't really random. If you use actual random numbers, then you have to ship them somewhere. That's called a one-time system. Russians use a lot of that. But the things we're talking about, you have machines that, in some sense, by definition, don't do random things. It's random if no machine can do it. And so the different things we're discussing are broken in different ways. Enigma turned on some critical points about the way it never enciphers a letter into itself. And building a device called the Turing bomb that does a controlled search of a lot of things in parallel. So it both involved a lot of computing and a lot of thinking.
I want to. We only have a few minutes left, and I have three things I want to ask you. One is a softball, open-ended question. What's one thing you want to tell our listeners that either relate to the career of cryptography or work in general, or some takeaway? Because 99.9999% of our listeners are never going to be cryptographers or know anybody who is, or their kids are not going to be one, but they want to take away something that's that will help their lives. Okay. Is there anything in your work life that you want to share with us that would be helpful?
Yeah, well, the great lesson of my work life is I've had a very non-standard work life. Right? I like to say I now have two doctorates, both of them honorary, both of them given by prestigious institutions. I never had an earned doctorate, and I wasn't a very good student, and I managed to overcome that all and be quite successful. But I learned in the process that it's by and large much easier to do things in the standard form.
Hmm. Yeah.
The other is, I mean, a certain amount of adventures. Now, the best investment I ever made in my life, and my father was very, very sarcastic about it, was to leave a good job at Stanford and go around traveling around, sitting in cafes, sitting in lunchrooms at universities, going to university libraries, and studying this one subject.
There's a million people who, as it's almost like a rite of passage, they graduate from San Francisco State with their degree in activism of some sort, and then they go to Nepal, or they drive around the country, or they do something, and they come back unchanged. You did it, and you came back. You said it was the best investment of your life. What lesson can you teach us about how to do that trip around the country or the world or whatever that might make other people's explorations more fruitful?
Well, while I was traveling around the country, as I've said, I was doing three things. I was looking up hard-to-find manuscripts in libraries. That's much less necessary these days. I was talking to anybody I could find willing to talk about the subject. Right? And I was thinking about it all the time. So
You could have thought about it at home. You didn't have to travel.
Okay. Somebody could have. Why not say I could have sat down and, you know, taken relevant courses and gotten a doctorate, and that would have helped.
Where did
well,
they
some
travel?
Things I can do.
What? So why was it?
I
traveling?
Set out from here and went to Cape Canaveral to watch a Saturn V launch.
You say you got anybody to talk with you. Now, I'm picturing you're talking with people who are like Princeton theoretical mathematicians and NSA.
Oh, you used to have jokes on this show about the hedge fund manager who makes billions a year. I went to see him. We were talking in the middle of the night at his place
on Long
Island.
How'd you get a meeting with him? Now, come on, I couldn't get a meeting with him. How'd you get a meeting with him?
He's much fancier these days than he was then. It was 40 years ago.
But even so,
he had a nice house on the north shore of Long Island. That's how I saw him. He had a much nicer house on the south shore.
But seriously, there are many people who, even at the lowest level, who are just looking for their entry-level job straight out of their bachelor's degree or before, and they can't even get an email answered, not even a rejection. And you're getting – what advice do you have on getting to meet with big people other than being a genius? That's not going to help.
The trouble is there's no answering this question, because 40 years ago was 40 years ago. The world was different, and today I'm notorious, which helps me to get contacts with people.
Notorious is a negative. Notorious.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Cryptographers are notorious.
Okay.
Not famous cryptographers. Cryptographers are notorious.
You have an edge. You know, you violate every stereotype that I have about nerds. You are extreme. You are sartorially splendiferous. You dress extremely. Here you are on the radio, and you're wearing a sport jacket, dressy pants, a lovely fine sweater, and everything. See, I would think, and in your personality, when you got the award, you were like a bon vivant. You were the ultimate raconteur and introducer of people. You know, are you considered an outlier among your computer nerd peers?
You got to ask somebody else.
Come on.
I think. There are people who dress well, or people who don't like. A lot of my life, I in principle wouldn't dress. My mentor in that is a former director of research at NSA named Dick Leibler, and he introduced me to West End tailoring in London.
Well, you know, you should see this guy though. Despite that, don't think he looks conservative. There is a movie in the Harry Potter movie, Dumbledore. Have you ever seen it? He's got this long gray hair, wispy hair. He's a guy who's in his 60s or something like that. And
I think he was older. I think he's died. I think the actor's died.
Yeah, but anyway, I'm trying to be nice to you. Anyway, okay, I'll get serious again. Another important takeaway, something that you and I have had a huge back and forth is about the importance of math, not for the future cryptographers. Of course, future computer scientists, engineers, mathematicians, they need to study math in college at least. But except for them, and especially at the pre-college level, where 99.9% of students will never use more than a dust mote of algebra, geometry, or calculus. It really strikes me at my core that it is not worth the opportunity cost of what the kids could have been doing with those 4 years of time in the math course. They can't spend the time on everything. We should be teaching them, instead of quadratic equations, we should be teaching them to think probabilistically. We should teach them
I don't disagree with that, incidentally. Okay, I think learning more.
Fine, but let's even forget about all this whole 4 years of math. There are so many critical life survival skills, like conflict resolution or public speaking even, that budgeting, that never even get taught because of the elitist view that every student needs to learn quadratic equations. What do you really think about that?
I think, in particular, our argument started with the importance of geometry.
Right.
And what I said to you was geometry was the only real mathematics you study in high school. And the sense in which it is real mathematics is that geometry is about proofs.
Right.
And this is I have an economic view of mathematics. Egyptian mathematics was experimental. There's something called the Amoser Papyrus. They list the formula they knew. I don't think they knew the Pythagorean theorem. But if they had, there would have been things like a government grant to go measure a triangle that was 20 miles on one side and 10 miles on the other side and see if the hypotenuse was really the square root of the sum of the squares of the sides, right? The Greeks discovered something that makes all of this much more efficient. You have a few assumptions. You can do experiments. You can test those, etc. And then you can figure out many, many more theorems by deriving them from the original assumptions. And that is what makes mathematics such an incredibly valuable tool in all of engineering and science.
For the 0.1% who are going to use it.
How are people going to discover that they like it?
Because those who are naturally attuned to mathematics will, even if they never touched it in high school, will have plenty of opportunity in college. We're talking about exposing 48 million kids in high school to something that only 1 out of 1,000. Why don't we think probabilistically and say, we have this treasure called time. X amount of time that the kids are going to be in high school. Let's spend it on that which has the highest probability of improving their lives and improving society's lives. No?
I think the probable main answer to that is, of course, historical syllabi are very hard to change. And so you try to redraw the civil
list. That's
true. You're up against a lot of how to figure out what the best things to study are. I don't know often.
You know what? Perfect is the enemy of the good. I don't think anybody could argue that I learned 34 geometric proofs when I took high school geometry and understood them and could even explain how they came about. And you know what? It did not make me a better overall thinker. It had minimal impact. I'm quite sure I parsed out that as not critical to the way I think. I've never used any of it, and there is so much more that I could. For example, social intelligence. It has taken me 50 years to develop even a dust mote of social intelligence, and it would have been invaluable for me to spend those 4 years, instead of learning geometry or algebra or precalculus or whatever, to have been learning the art of understanding how to influence people, ethics, and how you can retain your ethics and still be influencing and manipulative. It's crazy what we do in high school, it seems to me.
I'm prepared to believe you, but I haven't tried to work on a new syllabus.
All right. One more, and this is just because I have this odd interest in it myself. One, you were appropriately, while you were a key or the key, pardon the pun, to increasing quality of computer security in the world, one of your other colleagues who is almost as instrumental, we'll say, is Ralph Merkel. I happen to know him a little bit. He is actively involved in something called the cryonics movement, that people choose to freeze their bodies or just their brain in liquid nitrogen in hopes that 50 years, 100 years from now, that we can all be restored and live in the world of the 22nd century. Well, when I asked you if you ever talked with them about cryonics, you said, is it possible to talk about Ralph about anything else? Now, why would anybody as smart as Ralph Merkel focus on something that has such a small probability of working, even 100 years from now, that after you're dead, we're going to rejuvenate all your dead cells that are completely destroyed and mushed up into a perfectly functioning human being with a perfect mind and perfect and no pain?
Well, I mean, I think I've had the thought that maybe one should do that not because you think your consciousness is going to come back, but because there will be techniques developed for digging your memories out of your old brain, and that would be of incredible value to the historians of the 22nd century.
And the historian thing keeps coming up for you.
Yeah, you don't think I should teach history in high school either. At least you said that in some of our emails.
It's how you teach history. If you taught history by putting, if your history course was 100 critical incidents in history and immersingly using holograms and other kind of virtual reality, putting them in a situation of deciding what would you do in this situation and why, and having classes debate on it, I'm more than happy to teach
Sounds
history.
Great. Let's do that.
All right, let's do that. All right, one more final question, career thing. Looking back on your life, hopefully you live another 30 years, but one never knows. But if you were looking back and you were 18, what would you do? Would you choose the same career? Would you choose a different career? Would you choose a different path toward your accomplishing things? What would you do the same? What would you do differently, career-wise?
Okay, I don't know how to understand that question. I mean, if I were 18 now, but somehow with the insights of being 17 now.
Yeah.
I mean, the first thing, of course, is the stuff I have worked on was never the most important thing in the world, and it's much less the most important thing now. Advising young students, go work in biology. That's gonna dwarf computer science. I mean, it's not gonna be very separable from computer science, but biology is just gonna change everything.
As in personalized medicine and curing cancer.
Yeah, and genetics
and increasing intelligence and building
creatures by synthesizing genetic material from scratch and all the rest of these things.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. So you would do that at 82? Would you go the biology?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it probably. I don't know what I would do. I mean, as I say, I can't take the question seriously. I can pontificate on what I think young people should do, and I don't think there's anything wrong. I think mathematics is just immensely important, and if you're talented at it, it's worth doing it. If you've got another moment, I'll point this out to you, that it impresses me, so to speak, how far down and how far up it is. So, probably plausibly, you say 99.9% of the people don't use any mathematics. So probably I know more mathematics or I'm better at mathematics or something like that than 99% of the people. There was somebody there at the awards ceremony who merely became a fellow of the ACM.
Which is huge.
Who invent...
American Council on Machinery. It's the computer organization.
Association of Computing Machinery.
Yeah.
But the summer before I went to MIT... He will not be remembered in the pantheon of 20th century mathematics. Well, Wiles will be, right? You mentioned him. Several other people will be. But the point is, the best mathematicians I know, as opposed to having met, right, won't be remembered particularly as mathematicians when people look back from the 25th century and say, there was Archimedes in Greece, there was Newton, and there was Gauss. There were one or two people in the 20th century. And so the spectrum of ability in mathematics is just incredible. And, I'm sure a lot of these people were in some sense lucky, the same way I clearly have been lucky. I set out to study something that turned out to be vastly useful just because it fascinated me.
Isn't it crazy? It's true. Luck has a much... The older I get, the more I realize that there is ability, but luck matters a lot. Your idea could have greater implications or less implications than you think, and some of that is completely beyond your control and is a matter of luck.
Yeah.
On that point of agreement, what I think I'm going to do? If you're willing to stick around, I promised you, and I told you before the show and my listeners, that I really have this obligation of my listeners to give them a chance to call in for a workover, because they all are, they find this interesting, but they're all worried about their career in these ever tougher times, and so I want to give listeners a chance to do that. But if you are willing to stick around a little bit, I will also give my listeners an option, if they choose, to call in to ask a question to Whitfield Diffie, the winner of the Turing Award it's the Nobel Prize, essentially, for computer science, a world-class cryptographer. So, for either of those two reasons, you are now invited to call. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem, the phone number here, I usually try to help. I call them workovers, no pummeling involved, although sometimes I'm tough, sometimes I'm nice. Depends on you. The phone number for a workover, 415-841-4134. That is also the number if you have a question or comment for Whitfield Diffie, the winner of the Turing Prize, as I said, the million-dollar prize for essentially the Nerd Nobel in computer science. The phone number again,
415. We should thank Google for having jacked it up to $1 million. It used to be less than that.
Other than Google, who funds it?
Frankly, I don't know. I mean, I assume that there is some pot of money at the ACM, and that various people, it's gone up over time. Gloria Minsky told me that when her husband won it in 69,
Marvin,
I think,
Minsky, MIT's guy, key guy in artificial intelligence, yeah.
And that they just paid their way out here. She didn't think they got any money as such at all.
I said, wow, your timing was good. Okay. Anyway, the phone number, if you got a question for Whitfield Diffie, 415, or comment, 415-841-4134. And we already have calls. We have a call on the line. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hi, it's you. Are you there? Hello.
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
Marty?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, my name's Harriet, and I just started listening to your show recently.
I'm not hearing you very clearly. Can you either speak more directly into the phone or something? You sound like you're on a cell in the car or whatever.
Yeah, let me...
This is the radio. You got to at least make sure you're going to... Go ahead.
Is that better? Okay, yeah. Yeah, I just started listening to your show recently, and I'll try to be short to the point. Basically, I'm 34. I have my bachelor's degree in economics. I've been working in various roles as a budget financial business planning analyst for the past 7-8 years. And one of my problems and struggles is just, attention, retention. I've talked to physicians, psychiatrists, therapists about it, and they said, I struggle with depression. And that's, affecting my ability to, just have higher energy levels, stay focused, retain information, also struggling with the constant flow of information, which is crucial in my line of work. And I was just wondering, do you have any recommendations, for people that may be struggling with issues like that? Is there certain types of work more suited for them or more secure for them or where they're able to function in? Because now, I do take medications for this to try to help, but it only helps so much.
Okay, let's try to play diagnostician here. Let's start. Have you always had this problem?
Yeah, since I was been a teenager, just struggled with depression, anxiety. I do take antidepressants and anxiety medications for that, and it's just really tough for me to focus and pay attention to meetings, what people are saying. Now, I've asked my doctors, do I have ADD, ADHD? They say, no, you would have been diagnosed with that as a youth, but they do think it is highly attributable to, major depression. And so for me, it comes up in the adverse form of, negative performance reviews, saying, well, this Curtis doesn't seem engaged, he doesn't seem to retain the information and training, and it's not for lack of effort, it's just that it is literally hard for me to just retain information in general, given that so much of it is through a verbal interchange.
Right. Are there contexts in which you do have good retention, either when the information is presented visually, as in books or in pictures, or in quiet environments, when you've taken a break on the medication, has it improved? Are there circumstances under which your retention is better? Content material that's more compelling to you?
Yes, it is. It's just going through, when I think about, going through school, K through 12, college, I could never really retain or learn from lectures, but as long as I had a textbook or something to, refer back to, read from, take notes, do, kind of flashcards, sort of practice stuff, I always did well at that. And so for me, I think being able to do something that's very routine, where it's habitual, and so my minor actually in college was education studies, and so when I was looking to graduate, I thought about going into teaching, but I went the finance route instead, and just things, are very much fast, on the go, ever-changing, and it's just tough for me to keep up with. So I'm wondering, maybe would that be better to go into something perhaps, more secure, like teaching, where, you do have some...
No, too much variability. It's the opposite of routine. Listening to what you say, I want you to tell me what you like and don't like about the following vision. Since you've got a financial background, you are more quantitatively oriented, but you need structure. I think of auditors. Their auditing, can, of course, be very high level. Forensic auditing can be extremely sophisticated and variable. But let's say, I'm just trying to get a sense of a starting place for our discussion here. If you were to get trained to be a basic auditor, like a basic IRS auditor, is kind of very much, it's very ritualized. You go and you look and you see which score, which of his items on his return fall outside what they call the discriminant function, what's the expected range. You know, that's one more than one or two standard deviations. Let's say you report $30,000 a year, but you take a $15,000 charitable taxable deduction, that's going to no doubt score outside the range. But it's very mechanical. Does the idea, I don't say you need to work for the IRS, but the idea of doing the kind of new number-centric, therefore visual-centric work that is not attending meetings, where you're reviewing some documents and scoring them according to some criteria that are laid out, what feels right and wrong about that vision?
I like it, but I should also add that, you know, one of my other struggles is working directly under somebody's thumb. I don't.
Great, that's easy, well, because more people these days are working as freelancers and independent contractors.
Yeah.
So what if you're an outsourcer, you're working for a temp agency that does some of this auditing work, for starters, to get to try out a new field, and if you screw it up, you can always go to another one. You're not stuck there forever, but it's a way to try out that kind of concept. Let's say I know you don't have the skills now, but let's say I wanted you to take a course, an online course, so it's very visual again, an online course, you're not having to listen to lectures, an online course in some aspect of kind of an auditing, broadly defined, and mm-hmm. then use that as the launch pad for at least a temp gig, so that you can test out whether that's going to be a better fit for you. What feels right and wrong about that?
Okay, I could check that. Do you think operational or financial auditing would be more appropriate?
Whatever is going to leverage your existing knowledge base, so you're not having to spend a lot of time and money without making income. So do you know, given the kind of work you've done, is there some kind of routinized, visual-centric, number-centric kind of auditing, review? I mean, I think in the non-visual space, I think of restaurant inspectors. They've got to go in and they have to look at certain things. They've got a checklist. They're looking at a written checklist. They've got to look behind the sink. They got to look under the floor. They got to do this. They got to do that. They got to make the temperature of the refrigerator. It's all structured. I'm thinking about that, but something that would something numeric is going to leverage off your finance background more than being a restaurant inspector. Are we in the right church? Wrong pew? What's the deal?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I think just part of it is this: I don't handle continuous criticism well directly.
That's why I want your independent contract.
Working. Yeah, but part of me is also thinking like teaching math. You know, I'm really interested in doing something more kind of public service oriented, where, you know, whereas sitting behind a desk and maybe just crunching numbers and auditing, I don't know that I'm feeling fully fulfilled.
Well, it's an empirical question. Rather than try to decide this, let's say, do you have a friend who's a math teacher and let you give a guest class where you're going to have this? One of the biggest challenges in math teaching these days is the heterogeneity of the students in the class. There are going to be some. Yeah. We have high standards for all students. So you got kids who can barely know the tens place from the hundreds place, who are being asked to do pre-calculus, and you got other kids who are Whitfield Diffie types. So, had you thought about seeing empirically what occurred? Now, agree. Obviously, the first time you go and teach, you're not going to be great. But whether you feel that is an area of potential, should you try that as well as something more number centric that is behind the scenes? What do you think?
Yeah, I'm open to doing to trying both. I mean, last year I did sit in on some classes. I called a couple high schools and I said, hey, you know, I'm curious about teaching math. Can I sit in and just see, you know, what's it like? So I picked a couple high schools. One that was, you know, very much affluent area, high performing academically, and then one that was more inner city, low performing. And you know, there was definitely stark differences in terms of the classroom behaviors and how the teachers managed those students, but it gave me, you know, good insights as to, I think, something that I could foresee myself doing, you know, being more relational. You know, I've always liked working with youth in the past. But
I'm going to interrupt you for interest of time because I've got other callers, but I would say that, you know, there is a Grand Canyon of difference between watching it and doing it. I can watch a great Olympic trial or the Tour de France or whatever. It doesn't mean I don't know that there's a million, even in something as basic as motorcycle or bicycle riding, there's a million subtle nuances. I would like you to try out, not tutoring. Tutoring does not generalize to classroom teaching. They are extremely different because the classroom management running the 30-ring circus is a very different story. I invite you to see if you can get a friend who will let you teach a guest class.
Okay.
And pure lecture doesn't work. So it's got to be lecture combined with not just questions and in discussions, but creating little activities that will kind of help the kids in understanding their fabric, the concept you're trying to teach. And that will give you at least an initial clue whether it's worth going through the enormous work of getting a teaching credential. It's a pain in the ass.
But yeah.
All right. On that note, I want to thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you, Marty.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hi. It's you.
Hello, Marty.
Hello.
Oh, it is me. Okay. I just wanted to make a comment, and that is about mathematics education throughout school. I just think that it should be part of the regular curriculum as it describes the physical world around us. And I noted that your guest made a mention of the importance of studying biology. So I think as a good citizen, you probably should have some understanding of the three-dimensional world that you live in. And biology certainly is another one where I don't know how you can get away with mathematics, particularly when you start thinking of the branch of statistics. And that's about all I had to say on that topic.
Thank you very much. Let me respond to that topic, and maybe I'll let Whit do it, but I need to talk first here. You know, would be nice is great. To have an understanding of the three, I mean, the listenership of KAW, I think of as the ultimate, who hate the word elitism. The only word it hates more is sexism and racism. They hate elitism. Sure, it would be very nice to have an understanding of the three-dimensional world, but when people are shooting each other in the streets, when they can't have no impulse control and they're getting high on drugs, when they can't understand a newspaper, when they can't handle a budget, whether they can't figure out how to keep from getting ripped off as a consumer, it would be nice to know three-dimensional. Isn't that the height of elitism?
So, because I think we're bumping up more against the limits of our physical environment, particularly the state of oceans. For example, something as simple as jellyfish and the impacts that they have on our lives. I mean, I think that, yes, I can see where someone might call it elitism, but the fact is the biosphere is what supports.
You know what, this is a little off topic because I want to stay on the career thing. So, yes, it's important, but I appreciate your call. Thanks very much for the call. Let's take one more call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. What is your question or comment?
For Mr. Diffie,
why,
with all this genius, can't you stop spammers from reaching us and ruining our time?
That's interesting. The short answer is I haven't worked on anything that's directly like that. But I use Gmail, and I've noticed that they've managed somehow to stop most of the spam. I get very little through that. So it seemed to me that's part of the problem that progress had been made on.
Hmm. And then related to Gmail, quick question. Why does Gmail and Yahoo Mail and everyone else want our phone numbers now, even if we've had these accounts for years? Is it to stop something, or is it to collect marketing?
Well, I don't know. In Gmail's case, I think they asked for a phone number. They didn't demand it. They asked for it so that they could send me a one-time password if they had some doubt that it was me. I don't know what Yahoo does.
Thank you. Same thing.
I'm sorry. What'd you say?
Said the same. Yahoo does the same thing.
Anyway,
that seems to me a sensible enough.
Thank you for the call. You know what? Rather than asking for more calls or doing more calls, I have an important question to ask you, actually. You have an unusual challenge that every married couple has, but yours is kind of magnified, if I might. May I do this? May I ask about this?
Ask Mary. Go ahead.
Well, you have a wife who's got, let's say, a challenge. She's facing a serious challenge which takes a lot of time, of your time. What's your calculus for work-life balance and the importance of relationship versus work versus avocation? You have many avocational interests. You're interested in a million things. What are your thoughts about work-life balance and all that?
I don't conspire about this the way a lot of people do or say they do. Mary and I have always put loving each other above almost everything else. we spend lots more time together. Lots of people would spend much more time at their offices and things like that. So, and I've known quite a variety of people whose personal lives don't work very well, and it's clear it's because that's not what's important to them. They spend all of their time working. So I think it's just a fact of our lives that for these 40 years or so, we have put to spending time with each other first. I don't want to say put each other first sounds very, very formal, very, very noble, very, very high-handed. We've enjoyed each other and...
So it sounds like it wasn't a conscious choice. It's not like you said, you know, it says in the cosmic scheme of things, it's more important for me to spend hours 40 through 60 with my wife than 40 through 60.
Well, I never think about anything that way.
Right. That's so interesting because you're the computer guy and I'm not. And yet, so you didn't think, you don't think consciously that hours 40 to 60 are better spent with your wife than I'm working. You just let it happen. It's more of a feeling thing?
Yeah, I mean, I might get desperate with something that needs to be finished at work, right? And spend time working instead of doing something together, or we might get absolutely fascinated with doing something together, and work can go where it goes.
How does a computer program? I mean, you would think the computer programmer is the most hyper-rational person who would think out how to optimize. I mean, computer programming is all about optimization. Cryptography is all about optimization. Why would you not consciously think about how to optimize every hour of your life?
I don't. I don't know how I could not. I just don't. That's...
Okay. How would your wife? I have just a few seconds. How would your wife describe you as the work side of you and the personal side of you?
I take the fifth. Not sure there'd be whiskey or no. I'm sorry. I really can't answer that kind of question for her. You can have her on and find out what it's like to be an Egyptologist.
Anyway, I wanted to give you one, you know, one that more softy type question, but you're resisting, so I will.
No, I'm sorry. That didn't seem like a softy type question. It just didn't seem I don't know the answers to those things.
Okay, well then I will simply thank you, Whitfield Diffie, for sticking around for the whole hour here on Work with Marty Nemco. He is the winner of the Turing Award, which really is it's like the Nobel Prize winner for computer science, because for some reason the Nobels don't have an award for computer science, and he is the winner for his really a quantum leap in the quality of computer security, and he's written a book that's not for the public, but he's asked me to tout it, and so I will. Before I open the first page, and all I see is I see more formulas. This is a book you probably shouldn't buy. It's called, but it is about the history of cryptography, called Breaking Teleprinter Ciphers at Bletchley Park. Bletchley Park is the place where Alan Turing broke the famous Enigma code, the Nazi code. So anyway, that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Debbie Kennedy, and of course all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers, and I'm going to take a shot at something. I am a nut about distillation. So I'm going to take a shot at telling you as much as I can about how to choose a career wisely, including telling you about a couple of dozen smart under-the-radar choices, and I'm going to try to do it in a total of 8 minutes. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
For the archive of Dr. Marty Nemco's articles, information on his 8 books, including his new book, The Best of Marty Nemco, plus how you can consult privately with Marty, go to martynemco.com. That's martynemko.com. And join Marty again next week morning, next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemco here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.